Welcome, everyone. This is episode 14 of the Big COC podcast. We're here in Toronto, and I thought I'd just mention where we are in Toronto, because we just say here we are. This is the administrative offices of the COC. We're at 227 Front Street East, and this is where all the office types hang out, and it's where our rehearsal studios are. So that's where you're hearing this from. I've got four great guests here with me today. Two of them are returning. One, of course, we have Wayne Gooding. He's the editor of Opera Canada magazine. He's on the COC Speakers Bureau and probably going to be traveling this summer, I don't know, to check out some of the music festivals.
Bayreuth,
okay. We'll have to get your... Last summer we did a report, a live report from Bayreuth.
Yeah, we should do that.
Really?
So we should do that again this year by Skype.
We can do a live one on the new ring.
That was great.
That's where I'm going, yeah.
Oh, wonderful. Oh, that would be good to hear about that. And also returning is John Jilks. Hi, John.
Hi.
And John is most well-known to the opera audience for his blog, operaramblings.wordpress.com. And are you going to continue writing over the summer?
Yeah, I expect so.
Yeah. He's always good for a new post a day, at least.
I try.
And for the first time joining me today are two new faces, but they're certainly not strangers to the Toronto opera scene. We have in the studio from Against the Grain Theatre, Joel Ginger Ninja Ivany, who is the... I got these from your website. I couldn't resist. He's the founder and artistic director of Against the Grain. Hi, Joel.
Hi. Hello.
Great to have you here. And also Christopher Matsobal Majewski, who is also a founding member, and he's the music director.
Two very serious analysts of opera, apparently,
yes.
With those kinds of nicknames.
This is a serious organization.
Yeah, opera is serious stuff.
Opera serious. Like last week, we had Opera Hot. So, and I'm your host, Gianmarco Segato. I'm the Adult Programs Manager here at the COC. So I thought we'd jump in on our first topic today, especially taking advantage of our two new guests who are hot off amazing run of Figaro's Wedding here in Toronto, and it was so well received by everyone who saw it, I think, and the press. And but particularly today, what I maybe to discuss a bit is this, and it's been now christened a transladaptation, and that's a word copyrighted by Lydia Perovich, who has also been a guest on the podcast, who has a blog, definitely the opera. In her review, she talked about the transladaptation, which, can you explain, like, what that means?
Well, when I wrote it, people were thinking that it was just another version of the story as De Ponte said it, but it's basically a whole new story, and the bones are, the themes are still there, but it's entirely different. It's set in 2013, it's set in Toronto with... sort of, the names are all similar, but they're different characters from what De Ponte and Mozart came up with as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's what impressed a lot of people, was that here we were with, you know, a really somewhat reimagined version, and yet all the relationships that we know from the so-called traditional Marriage of Figaro were intact. Which
in some ways it's a bit like evolution. I mean, like, we have a common ancestor, and the common ancestor was the original version, and then this one's kind of some random mutations, not so random, but some mutations, and it went in a different direction. So.
Right. So what was that, in a nutshell, what was that process like? I can't even imagine. Like,
well, it's an idea that we wanted to do for a while, and it was just kind of stirring in the brain. We had a great sort of success with the Bohème, so we were looking at doing something that people would have known of, but then was... how do we make it English, but then how do you make it sort of fit with doing what we like to do? And so it just kind of boiled down to process of just, I guess, like a fine math equation. You just kind of narrow it down, and it kind of sifts into what it is, but we wanted to make it shorter. We wanted to, and which is difficult with Figaro, because there's such beautiful music throughout the whole thing. And so we just kind of made incisions where we felt it was appropriate, and then just kind of wanted to tell a story, and it's hard to kind of boil it down from there.
Well, one of the people that, you know, there's been a lot of commentary on your version of Marriage of Figaro, but the one I wanted to focus on a bit today, it was sort of interesting, was John Terodes in his Musical Toronto blog. And I'll just quote a couple things of what he said. He loved the production, and one thing he remarked on, he says, my great-grandparents and grandparents were used to hearing opera in their language. No need for surtitles, which had to be invented in Toronto, by the way, by the Canadian Opera Company, by the way, I'm adding that part, because late 20th century operatic Puritans demanded that every work be presented in its original tongue. Then he goes on to say, most current directors and companies steeped in this recent tradition, and what he means by that is the tradition, I guess, of performing in the original language, they shrink away from the truly radical gesture of presenting an opera in the language of its main audience. The cult of purity and authenticity prevents people from changing anything in the text, so everything that is adapted or modified has to be done in the dressing, and by that he means the staging. And I just, you know, whatever for what it's worth, it's a point of view, obviously, but I thought this was a really interesting thing. I hadn't thought about this before. Like, is this a new way to go forward, since so much of the operatic repertoire is, let's face it, old? So I don't know. What do you guys think about that? Wayne? I don't want to put you on the spot, but it seemed like you had something to say, maybe.
Well, actually, I was just nodding my head when we were talking about surtitles being invented in Toronto. I mean, they were that's a very Western view. Actually, the Chinese used surtitles in Chinese opera long before we used them.
Whoa.
They actually used glass slides. They weren't surtitles, they were side titles, actually.
Ah,
so it goes back a lot, much longer than, much further back. But that's a side issue.
Yeah, that's good to know.
I have written about this before, actually, just to set the record straight there. But, okay, is this the new way to go? First of all, I have to say, I love the Figaro's wedding. It was a great evening and really entertaining. Mozart's Marriage of Figaro was finally funny for once, for me. And as I think I said to Joel on the evening, I saw it was without the longueurs or anything else.
Yeah.
So it caught the essence of it very, very well.
Oh, I really missed Marcellina's aria.
Well, now this is the thing. You see, that, you know, okay. So
no.
The window is open. Here we go.
Yeah, no, I mean, first of all, I think it's an interesting way to go, but I wonder how far you can go with it, actually, is I guess where I want to go with this. I mean, I don't think everything will allow itself to this kind of treatment. Your previous production of the Daria One Who Disappeared and the Kurtag Fragments, I don't think you would have rewritten that one to put it into English. And God knows that one, for all of the audience, needed to be in English in some way, you know, because who speaks Hungarian or whatever it is, you know, for us here. But I thought it was very good. What intrigued me about it actually was why this word that's been used, transladaptation, is interesting. To what extent, though, what was going through my mind, is this a parody or not? Is it a parody of Mozart? I mean, I don't mean a disrespectful parody, but in the end, it takes some of the very essence of the Mozart opera, presents it in a way that's absolutely engaging and very funny. But I'm not sure that it's Mozart's opera in the end. You know, it's your take on it. And I applaud you for what you did. But I think that's where I would see it. And I wonder how much farther you could take it. You mentioned, Joel, the Bohème. That wasn't quite so deconstructed.
That was more like a straight,
this really isn't just about putting opera into English, into the native language. I mean, that's not such an old thing. There was a time where it was done everywhere. I mean, you go listen to German recordings of Italian opera, and they're all done in German.
I did a video of Fischer Dieskau singing arias from Don Giovanni in German.
Does something very different.
Did with it really was the essence, the way you reconstructed it, but actually remained faithful to the original at the same time. I thought that was very, very
good. You can go further, and I think that's one of the really fascinating things about this opera season in Toronto, is that it closed with Figaro's Wedding, but it opened with A Synonym for Love, which took a Handel cantata, I guess, and put a completely new libretto to it. In English, telling a story staged in an extremely innovative way, so that you didn't even get to see the whole thing. You only got to see part of it, depending on how you decided to look at it.
Okay, but then, sorry.
So, I guess where I was coming from is, I totally agree with you that there are some works that you can take further than others. I mean, I think that's pretty clear. But I started to think of it from the point of view of, we have the opera companies in town that can do, you know, fully staged classical works with a full orchestra and chorus. I mean, the COC, obviously, but also Opera Italiana.
Mm-hmm. And then we have all kinds of people trying to do slightly different things, you know, and a lot of it turns out to be a semi-staged opera in concert in acoustically rotten spaces, of, you know, very straightforward versions of very mainstream works. And I don't know, I just can't get excited about those if I'm not going to go and see Ben Hepner sing Tristan. Then I'd much rather go and see A Synonym for Love or Figaro's Wedding rather than, you know, a bunch of okay, but people putting on a completely straight version of Marriage of Figaro at Heliconian Hall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I take your point. I mean, I don't think it's either or you know. I mean, I mean, all is welcome and all is encompassing in this. I used the word parody, and as I'm thinking here, thinking of it, maybe that's not quite the right word. I'm trying to figure out.
I don't think parody, in its larger sense, though, is no. I mean, it has negative connotations.
Yeah, I don't.
Usually,
mean,
I don't think it does.
That.
I mean, it's sort of.
And it's also.
Let me use another word, and that's novelty. It becomes a novelty act. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And maybe that's because there haven't been enough of them yet that it does sort of stand on its own, but. So it's not though. Okay, what's bothering? It's nothing's bothering me about it. I mean, in the end, though, you are deconstructing. We're not going to end up with Mozart or whatever opera or composer or whatever. I mean, De Ponte really did get lost here.
Yeah.
I mean, totally. Mozart didn't get lost, but De Ponte was right out of the picture. And so when I say, you know, how far can you go with that? I mean, I think it's in that spirit. I mean, how far are you willing to deconstruct? I mean, how far can you deconstruct, and when does it then make much more sense just to create something new?
Well, there's a long tradition of this, though. I mean, you know, the pastiche goes right back to the Baroque.
Mm-hmm.
You know, taking music from existing opera and putting new libretto
to
it.
Well, The Enchanted Island.
Yeah, Enchanted Island is a good example of a bad example.
But I think...
I mean, what John said, one thing that you said, there were a lot of great things, actually, but one thing that I would latch on to is sort of, I mean, this was a huge thing. I mean, Joel wrote it, and I know he struggled with how that, and I did also, even from, you know, we're all musicians, they grow up with, especially if you've come up, you know, started young, and you've got a tradition, and you've got teachers who were older, and they have very strong opinions about how things are, and so you're sort of instilled with, like, a semi, quasi-religious idea of, like, what you're doing.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I did, because Mozart was the thing that I loved since I was 4 or 5 years old. I was obsessed with Mozart, still am. And so I wondered, and I worried about that a lot. Is this, I mean, are we desecrating something? And I think there's a certain segment of the artistic community that would say yes. And I think, I mean, strictly speaking, we are, if you're looking at it from that vantage point. But what John said about there being a lot of options. So, I mean, I think one thing that we have to be concerned about, or one thing that we're concerned about against the grain, I'm concerned about in every aspect of work that I do, is being able to sort of at least present oftentimes things that are done very frequently in some new context or next to something new that changes the context, mm-hmm. or simply because, I mean, I think it really, even from my vantage point, loving, say, a piece like Marriage of Figaro, it sometimes is boring to see it, especially given the sort of, if it's really, you know, Puritan folk who are putting it on, or if it's just not very...
I'd like to see that, the Puritan version of
that. Yeah, well, not those Puritans, but...
I know.
Marriage of Figaro with Quakers. I think the thing is that the thing that allows us or made us feel like we had a bit of freedom is that our mandate is within the position that we fill or that we're starting to fill within the artistic community here and as artists in general. I think we have a bit of room because there's no lack of options in terms of seeing it done properly. You'll be able to see the COC do it.
Yeah. I think the other thing is, too, once you take the first step, you have logically to go to the end. So it's like cornering fast, you know, if you take your foot off the pedal halfway round, you spin out.
Yeah.
And I've seen versions of sort of tweaked modernization, the full flat, because they don't go far enough. There was a threatening opera done not very long ago which had like City Hall and stuff in it, but it still had the King's Mounted Messenger and, you know, the threat of execution at the end of anything, even though it was supposed to be modern Toronto. And, you know, it's when people do that, I mean, I see it in, you know, I mean, one of my pet peeves is people who shift Lucia de Lammermoor to the middle of the 19th century because the politics no longer makes any sense at all. and that kind of tweaking drives me nuts. I would much rather somebody went the whole hog.
Okay, but that's sort of coming back to what this article is about, because I think the title of it was The Real Problem with Opera Direction These Days, It Doesn't Go Far Enough. So
sometimes.
I think what he was implying is that you guys went pretty far, in a good way, you know, in a positive way.
Because what's difficult sorting through all this stuff is, in all essence, this was a workshop of this. This was the first time the singers aired it out. We didn't know how people would, we had no previews, we just jumped straight into four shows. So all feedback is good to just going forward with all this stuff. Mm-hmm. But I think this version could work in a bigger house with a bigger orchestra in some ways, and it's just in some ways it's not different from an older English version,
right?
Other than you're still seeing a story being told, other than you get into translating one particular word for another one and which one's the better one. But yeah, in some ways it is a slippery slope and how far do you go, and when we're the ones saying let's go either all the way, or then that kind of green lights us to really play around with stuff, and that's what's exciting.
I think about it, some of the most enjoyable things I've seen have been because somebody's dared to take a relatively radical approach. I mean, I don't know if you've seen the recording of the Salzburg King Arthur. I mean, a notoriously difficult work to do, right? Because it's got like 4 hours of Dryden in it. But they take the music, and they take the basic plot, and they really condense it, and they make it kind of wacky, and it's in German too. The music's sung in English, the dialogue's in German, Salzburg. And it's utterly brilliant. And, you know, you get to see Michael Schauder rocking out as a rock guitarist.
Well, it's interesting, though, isn't it? I mean, the examples we're using here are all relatively early opera. We haven't gone beyond the classical period yet. And maybe that is, when I say how far can this go, maybe that's as far as it goes, because it gets systematically more difficult the further in you into closer to our own time that you get. One of the things, I mean, just on the more general issue, but still in context here, of opera in the native language of the audience, is that one of the things that's problematic sometimes for me with opera in English is the translations are bad, not in the sense that they're necessarily, it's bad English, but it doesn't work with the music.
I have to say,
one of the things I thought worked particularly well, and it's a congratulation to you, Joel, is your English.
Very singable.
Libretto was singable, and it actually worked with the music extremely well.
And that meant it was
something
understandable.
And I think it also made
critical.
It very direct for the audience, because there wasn't this disconnect between what we were hearing from the musician on the musical side and hearing on the meaning side. So I mean, I think that's something that is a problem for a lot of opera, at least opera in English. I'm not sure whether it works in, you know, opera in German or Italian or whatever.
I would much rather, if I'm going to hear an opera in English, it's normally in another language, I'd much rather hear a version like yours, and like not everyone's going to be able to do that and spend all the time on that, I'm sure, than the kind of translation you're talking about, which we've all heard. I mean, you know, where Umbaldita
like
sounds funny, like one fine day. I don't know. Just
Well, and if anyone is going to dedicate themselves to doing an opera not in the original language, whatever language you're translating it in, I mean, that kind of attention to the musical, you know, because composers, I mean, this is one reason that you have to be very careful, because composers, great composers like a Mozart, like a Puccini, the ones who are really great at composing, Britten, Wagner, not all opera composers were necessarily as good at it, but the ones who were really great at setting their language, I mean, took exactly. Text and music are married in a way that is almost indistinguishable. I mean, like, so you really have to take the same level of care to at least, I mean, otherwise you've just bastardized it, or you've made a
don't know if I'm allowed to say that. Or
I've said worse.
Or you come up with this bigger problem, which I think is also a problem, even when it comes to, you know, the problem of pieces and if when they're directed in situations that are out of context and stuff like that. You have this the music, and you have this these elements that are not gelling together. And I think one thing that was really important for us is you may consider that we took a lot of liberties, but certain essential elements had to be there and must be there. And I think whether it's where you're, if you're a director transporting it to a different time or you're translating it or something, it really has to be very, everything has to kind of unite in a very Gesamtkunstwerk kind of way. Mm-hmm. Like if the direction causes you to get outside the music or does not coincide with what's happening musically,
right.
You no longer have a theater piece. You have like sort of three televisions on, one with baseball, one with, you know, Jerry Springer, and like they're all turned up and like, what do you watch?
Yeah.
What do you listen to? So, I mean, I think that how far you can go with it is up for debate, but at least every time you approach a production in any way, I think you have to think about that problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that we did, at least.
Yeah. Well, I think you did. I mean, I was interested that you called it a workshop, Joel, essentially, because I was actually struck very much by the audience reaction. Not so much, I mean, on the night I saw it, which I think was opening night,
it was Wednesday night, right? Yeah.
So, I mean, everyone was totally engaged by it, and that was fine. But what actually really struck me about it, and really showed that I think you touched a nerve somewhere in the audience, was that on the weekend I was at a couple of other events, and in the intermissions everyone was asking, did you see Figaro's wedding? I mean, it really did create a buzz around here that I think people were responding to something that they didn't normally see. So there is something there. It's not a one-off experiment, but hopes.
And I think that's what's been overwhelming and nice. Like you said, me, when I go to an opera, it's I saw opera in Berlin and an Italian opera where I sort of can understand the Italian. I'm watching German titles and I'm sort of understanding that. But I'm frustrated because I'm missing something.
Yeah.
And I know that there's some word that just would resonate, which gets overlapped. And just seeing people laughing at Figaro's wedding was just an incredible feeling, just to know that this doesn't happen that often in opera. People laughing in comedies.
Especially in the marriage of Figaro.
Or they're laughing at the wrong time. I mean, you know, this
at
is
the
problem with the
wrong
titles. They're great.
Timing, yeah.
And, like, you know, surtitles are amazing. You know, I mean, I think we wouldn't want to go back from that, although that might be debatable. I don't know. But it's just, I think comedies especially, it's a problem when people read the joke before it actually happens. I mean, that's always used as an example. But anyway, well, you know, congratulations, and I'm on to the next project. Right? since it's June 7th today, so we're at the traditional end of the opera season in most cities, except for the summer festivals, which are coming up, I suppose. But for the regular opera season, it's sort of done now. So I thought we would perhaps collect some of our opinions and some of the triumphs that we witness, and maybe some of the not so triumphs as well, and you know, live performances. They could be things you saw around Toronto, or maybe in other cities that you were visiting, or where you were working, and even if something really impressed you that you saw in a recording, a DVD or a live stream or an HD transmission. So, anyone have anything they want to talk about? They're just itching to jump in.
I know which one is the. And I must, you know, make a disclaimer straight away. I worked on my favorite thing of the season, hands down, by far, was the COC Sellers Tristan.
Right.
I thought it was amazing. Disclaimer, I worked on that show as a music staff member. So there are certain elements that, and Wayne, you'll be able to say this because I know you saw it. I don't know how many times you saw it, John.
Twice.
You saw it twice. I mean, I cumulatively saw it about 9 times. So certain elements that I heard a lot of feedback from a lot of people, a lot of things that some people didn't like, were, you know, not problems to me because I was able to see it so many times. I mean, I think some people would express, you know, problems having not knowing what to look at. I, of course, had seen it so many times. I knew which, what bits were, you know, I loved the little part where the kid blew the birthday cake candle out. That was amazing. It, like, made me cry every time.
And just to fill people in, I mean, this production was particular because it had huge videos by video artist Bill Viola playing in the background, just in case anyone hadn't seen it. So, yeah, what you're talking about is this difficulty that some people had, and I had it at moments in the production where you didn't really know what to focus on, or the video didn't seem appropriate, or... whatever.
I have to say that opening night, the second half of Act Two,
mm-hmm.
was the moment for me when the light really went on about Wagner.
Hmm.
I mean, I've enjoyed.
Are you not a Wagner fan?
No, I am.
Sorry, to me. Oh, that sounded so.
I mean, my introduction to opera actually was Wagner, 40 years ago. Listening to the Schulte recording on one of my school teachers' stereo. But I didn't like Wagner. It was light Wagner. But what I meant was suddenly that thing that makes people so utterly fanatical about
yeah.
Wagner, I suddenly got it.
Yeah.
Just at that moment in the big duet in Act Two, it's been earworming me ever since too, which is driving me nuts. but yeah, that was amazing music making.
I mean, part of it I think is it's certainly the piece.
Yeah.
I mean, and I love
yeah.
that. I love that piece. It was the piece that got me into opera when I was a kid. But also, I thought the production was very true to. There was a beautiful marriage because even though there was a lot going on, the video was. Magical in that it did not impose any kind of meaning. It gave people a lot of room to sort of embrace it or not embrace it as they wanted to. Now, it could be the fact that I was at all the stagings, but the staging actually of the singers, which did not necessarily always attract a lot of attention because there were these massive videos, but I thought the staging was remarkably intricate and beautiful.
I think what surprised a lot of us is that before we even saw this production, we just had this idea that singers would be standing there on this bare stage and not doing much. And you know, and that was something that
like
I loved, and it impressed me that they, like you say, like there was real interaction going on, you know, amongst the singers. And
It was, and what I found interesting about that was the second time I saw it, which was musically not quite so satisfying. I was sitting in the orchestra ring rather than the back of ring three.
Mm-hmm.
So I saw a lot more of the singers and a lot less of the video,
mm-hmm.
which was extra, and it didn't much. I noticed the staging much more from that vantage point than I, because actually from high up you couldn't see quite a lot of the staging because quite a bit of it took place in parts of the auditorium. And
right.
And you can't see that from the back of ring three.
Mm. I think I had a similar. It was maybe in one of the last rehearsals where I decided to sit quite close up. And I'd already decided, you know which videos you didn't want to watch or not watch. It was in an instance when I couldn't see or chose not to see, you know, and was close up, you could really notice that kind of interaction. But anyway, I could go on forever about that.
Yeah.
I really loved it. It's part, I think.
It's longer, for God's
sake. Well, I think, and it was all of those things, and it was also, it was being a part of that production, which was remarkable, and Sellers is one of the most amazing artists out there.
He's pretty incredible.
So
that
was easy. It was easy to get the best one. Who else is there? Who's going to slam
you,
something?
Well, it kind of tails on that similar one. In the fall, I was working at the Wexford Festival, but spent a day and went up to Dublin because they were putting on a Tristan and Isolde as well.
Oh, yeah.
And it was, for me, this production, it was an old set from the 70s, and this was a company that... It was their first opera. There's no national company in Ireland, so they got all the funding to do this, and for their first opera, they decided to put on Tristan and Isolde.
this was with Brett Polidato.
I saw
this. They live streamed it as well. Someone emailed me and said, "Are you watching this?" And I'm going,
"This was on
what?
In Paris as well, wasn't it?" I mean,
I don't
there was a bunch
think
of.
So, but
a bunch
I
of
may have done,
was
but
there,
I certainly saw the last
yes.
act from Dublin as well.
Yeah, so I went up just because Brett was in it, and it was him, an Irish soprano. Her name was Miriam Murphy, who sang Isolde.
How appropriate.
Yeah, and Lars.
Finally, an Irish Isolde.
Cornish King Mark.
And there was nothing overdone about it, but it was just, it told the story. and they were wearing just traditional kind of costumes and stuff, and there was just something beautifully haunting, and just her Liebestod at the end was just to die for, and just there was something really special about her being Irish, being in Ireland, and just the production just really, really worked. And from what I've heard, they've got another big goal planned for this coming fall, but that one really kind of stood out for me for just, it doesn't always have to be flashy and all this to be
right,
powerful.
That's true. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that struck me about this year in Toronto is there were remarkably few turkeys. I mean, really, it was, there were a couple of things I didn't like as much as some other stuff, but by and large, and the COC season was very strong. I thought, you know, the Opera Atelier Freischütz was an interesting take and definitely worth seeing for the experience. There was you guys, there was a Synonym for Love, there was some other, there was some really great stuff from Opera 5.
Mm-hmm.
You know, pretty strong all around season. I mean, I tried to think about what was my favorite COC show of the season, and I couldn't pick one. I totally couldn't pick one. There were four or five that were so good that I just.
And sometimes, like you were saying, it's the piece itself sometimes that makes the impression, and then other times it's the production, and it's hard sometimes.
Yeah.
Like for me, I know it would be a toss up between Dialogues of the Carmelites and Tristan, but I think that a big part of that, the productions were great, but it was just hearing that music live, which I'd never done before, either of those operas, so, you know. And Wayne?
Well, I wish I could add something new here. I mean, listening to try and listen, Tristan is my desert island opera, and so it was the highlight. And I'm such a German opera fan. This last part of the season with Tristan, Salome here, I went to New York to see the Parsifal at the Met. So I've been in sort of heaven all the time. and I'm going to single out something else here in Toronto, though, I think, which dovetails what I think is not the singing so much as the one thing that really, really impressed me yet again here was the COC orchestra. In the Tristan, in the Salome, in the Dialogue des Carmelites. I mean, it really is a superb band. I mean, and we're very lucky to have them. I think it's one of Richard Bradshaw's other great legacy to the opera community here, because he essentially built that orchestra. And I should add to that, since he conducted all three of them, Johannes Davis as well, I think a remarkable achievement this year.
Well, and especially because so many of those operas were his first time.
That's
they?
Right. Well, and the Tristan at such short notice as well.
That was incredible.
Yeah, so that was the high point for me. And just to be on a German theme, and on the not the low point, but more questionable point, I have to say, probably I was less enthusiastic with the style of Der Freischütz than you may have been.
Well, I
have to put it diplomatically.
So I know
what exactly you're saying.
I know exactly what you're saying. I mean, it was campy in a way that only Marshall can be campy.
But it was also Freischütz via Versailles as well.
Well, I thought musically, I thought it was interesting. I thought you know, using Tafel music and music of that period. Was a very, very, there were lots of things about that production that drove me nuts. I mean, like singing it in German using English dialogue, which is one of those things that I'm afraid is just not, doesn't work for me. Sure, there was the random.
It was an interesting take on it.
The random Marshall doesn't want to get divorced ballet in there. And
okay, on that note.
There were no castanets. Look on the bright side.
Oh!
One thing, before we move on, to latch on to what Wayne was saying about the orchestra, another thing that's amazing about them and that we should really be happy about is that, like a proper opera orchestra like the Met Orchestra, we have an orchestra that can go from one evening playing Tristan to Clemenza or Salome to Dialogues. I mean, that's crazy. I mean, because that's like, it's an extreme, and they're all the same players. I mean, I mean, when
give or take,
you know, a few more for Wagner than Mozart.
What interested me was I was fortunate enough to see Johannes rehearsing the orchestra for Fledermaus on one occasion, and what really impressed me as a non-musician was he had a very, very distinct idea of the sound that he wanted to get out of the orchestra for that piece, and it was a very unusual sound. I mean, basically, I think he wanted to make Strauss sound like Berg. And they responded. They totally got it. They totally got it. You could see it happening in front of you in the rehearsal. Hmm. And now, whether you think that was a good interpretative choice or not, the way you can't fault the way the orchestra responded. Hmm. It was really impressive.
No, they're amazing. They're amazing individuals, and as a yeah. collective group, they're amazing. And they know how to sort of work as an amazing team. Yeah. They're a great team. They're like a World Series winning team.
I can't wait to hear them do Parsifal here.
You might have to wait.
Oh, 2 years.
It'll come. Hopefully, yeah. So for our final story today, it's kind of a collection of things. I've just been noticing in some of the sort of classical music press, if that's what you want to call it, this increasing... Well, no, I just say, you know, I mean, it's not in the regular press anymore, as we know. It's mostly blogs, and which is great. I mean, it's at least we still get the news. But it's kind of interesting that there have been just sort of spate of stories lately of quite well-known singers and conductors who are like really dissing certain opera directors, or I mean, for instance, Robin Ticciati, who's actually a British conductor, very recently in Zurich, pulled out of a production of Don Giovanni in a production by Sebastian Baumgartner. It's a little suspect to me because he pulled out after two performances, so he'd been through the rehearsal process, but I don't know the whole backstory. But anyway, that's one example. Ferruccio Furlanetto, who is a great Italian bass, who will be here next season in Toronto singing Don Quixote, he's made it quite clear that he has a blacklist of directors with whom he refuses to work. Anyway, and the Polish tenor Piotr Beczala, this is a little bit of an older story, but just a month or so ago, he's got the black book as well. And he lists people like Calixto Bieto, Hans Neuenfels, Martin Kuzesch, I don't know if that's the right pronunciation, but anyway, and what he said, but what Beczala says, which I thought was kind of interesting, he said, I'm absolutely not against updating an opera. I'm not against modern. I'm against, and this is these are his words. I am against stupid, idiotic, and far-fetched. I refuse to work as a group therapist for frustrated stage directors. I refuse to pay for their therapy. Okay, it's kind of an extreme statement, but still, I think it's just interesting that these. I don't know. I guess feeling that in the past. These sort of opinions would have been kept very quiet. And part of it is just that we have like Twitter and we have all these other things, ways of things leaking out. But I don't know, Joel, as a stage director, how do you feel about some of these statements?
I know.
Yikes.
Well, I think North American audiences, if they haven't gone to Europe, kind of have no idea how different productions are there than North America. For what the COC puts on, yes, they challenge and push the limits, but what some of those directors put on is just much further, much crazier, much, and part of it is, so that's just in and of itself, that mm-hmm. what we think is, it just goes much further there. One of them was interesting because the singer who said he's got a blacklist of directors said he had conductors, but he wouldn't list any of them.
Oh.
Meaning just he's worried.
It's because they're the ones who might do the hiring.
Exactly. So it's just interesting about how that goes. I think several directors would have a blacklist of singers.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true.
I'm sure that's true. And that's a balance that's going back and forth. We're coming out of a time period kind of ended with Pavarotti. There's a couple big names now, but it's not as dominated by mm-hmm. the singers getting front page in the press when Maria Callas dies or something like that. Mm-hmm. So I think it's just kind of it's swaying back and forth, and yeah, I don't know. It's interesting.
Well, it struck me too that these are all people who are in pretty high position in the business who can say these things and not worry about losing work. Whereas there'd be a lot, you know, whole spate of other people who would not, you know, be able to say stuff like this. And.
And I'm sure that there are, you know, singers out there who've got, you know, Otto Schenken on that blacklist, you know. So, I mean, obviously singers and conductors have personal tastes. Mm. And if they're in a position to pick and choose because they're big draws and big names, they're going to do that. But it's big news when a singer says that they don't want to work with Herheim or Bieto. It's not news when a singer quietly avoids working with some thoroughly boring director.
It's true.
I come at this from like very multiple angles, but one angle that did sort of bother me, and I wanted to hear what everybody else thought about this. I mean, I don't like this feeling of people coming out and, you know, assuming that they're sort of, that they're so
shame.
I had something not disturbed.
No one's disturbed. I mean, I hate this feeling of people going into a process and not caring about the collaborative venture of it.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know the background, and I'm not going to slag anybody off, but, you know, if you leave two shows after an opening, you've left a whole number of people in a lurch, and maybe, like, Joel was telling me an interesting story about how, like, maybe it was planned, and, you know, like, this... companies may have all these internal things that are happening, and how they play out, you know, to eyes that don't see what's going on behind is one thing. But I mean, I just kind of, it's a turn off to everyone else, I think, outside, to have these people who are more concerned with sort of, you know, speaking of their own artistic integrity as individuals instead of caring more about being team players and going at it and working together. You know, there's something that smacks of the egotistical that I don't like. I think it's just a bit gross, and I think it turns other people off, because I think we need to be more about breaking down walls rather than putting up these elitist walls about ourselves, about, you know, what we're doing. And that's not to say that sometimes directors aren't doing crap or singers aren't doing, you know, I'm not saying that, and I'm definitely not saying anything goes, but sometimes if you're at show two, like, you're just going to have to suck it up and conduct the shows.
It reminds me a little bit of the conversation we had in the last podcast about the Tannhäuser that was pulled after the first performance.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, what is the company thinking here? They go all the way through with it, and then they get hit by controversy and
totally
then pull it off.
Controversy.
I mean, caught it as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'd sort of build on what you're saying. I think, you know, if you go into an enterprise, whether you go in as a director, a conductor, or a singer, for the most part, at the level that we're talking about, people are known quantities. I mean, if you sign up for a Beato production, you got a pretty fair idea of what you're getting into.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're up for that, great. If you're not, don't do it. Let somebody else have the gig. Don't get all holier than thou about it. Just don't do it. I mean, I know Susan Graham has directors she won't work with. She has made a song and dance about it.
That's true. When you get, I mean, this, most audience members don't see this, but when you get into a room with these types of personalities, if there is that kind, I mean, it ruins.
It ruins work.
I mean, you can see it on the stage too, but it really ruins work in the whole process.
It's no fun either.
For everybody to have these kinds of tensions and this kind of, you know, anger and animosity and everybody throwing their philosophical viewpoints. I mean, to a certain extent, talk about it at home or at a party over some bourbon, but like, we just got to all do our work.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's hard enough, right? You know, without how you deal with that sort of thing.
And I think it's also something bigger than our individual needs and wants. It's a much bigger process.
Does
it give into that?
Does it work better in ensemble houses? I don't, you know.
Two interesting things were how do people come for singers? Do they come for this interpretation of the story, the regie? And the Tannhäuser one is apparently still selling out, even though it's in concert style, which I guess it's nice just to hear that music and that orchestra. And then in Berlin, I saw this new opera called Joan of Arc, which was about Joan of Arc, but yet the director who directed it had died like days before it premiered, and the piece ended up being pretty much about him. He had videos of himself in the production, and it kind of centered around him and not Joan of Arc. The remount wasn't as successful, but again, how far do you go? And ultimately, I guess it goes to the top as to who's hiring these people to say, this is what I want to present to our public. And otherwise, it's arbitrary, I think, or it's just opinion.
Yeah.
How far
it's interesting, though, as you say, Gianmarco, that the singer discussion of this seems to be I mean, the audience discussion at this level has been on for some time now, mm-hmm.
right? Mm-hmm.
But it is interesting that now it's the inside
yeah.
professionals suddenly seem to, we're seeing it more, or maybe it is just social media is making it more apparent. The conversations have actually been going on all the time, but they're just
and
more
they're
public
just,
now.
They're recorded now,
yeah.
you know, and we get
I,
to hear
I don't
about
know.
Them. I don't know, it's hard to say. Again, it yeah. could be, we're sort of at the start of this, maybe, and maybe we'll hear more of this, or maybe we'll just die. Or, you know, I mean, you know, Ferruccio Fortunato has a very...
Well, the paycheck in the end is a powerful determinant of action.
Well,
Fortunato, I mean, both of those, as you say, I mean, they're A-list. I mean, they can
yeah.
afford to pick and choose,
yeah.
but that's
yeah.
not true of the majority of singers, I don't think.
Well, and my question, too, is, like, who these days is... even put is putting on, I don't know, traditional productions, like our super traditional productions. I mean, where if a singer really only wants to be involved with that kind of thing, I mean, it's going to be harder and harder, I think, to find those kind
well,
of productions
I mean,
anywhere.
Most
even the Met, I mean,
well,
they're not...
Well, the most regional houses in North America are still
yeah.
pretty much that
okay.
way.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
You know...
Or even you can do some work in Albany or something like that.
In Calgary.
Hey! Well, thank you very much for joining me today, everyone. It was great to have you. It was a lively conversation.
It was
and
an insane pleasure.
It was wonderful. Just a few remarks to close here to remind you that there are several ways to listen to these COC podcasts. You can visit COC Radio and go directly to our website and click on COC Radio and you'll find the podcasts. You can listen to them on the website. You can download the MP3s. And you can also go to iTunes, and I'd encourage you to subscribe on iTunes so that you're always updated when a new podcast is available. So this is Gianmarco Sagato in Toronto signing off, and until next time, we'll see you then. Bye-bye.